continuing interview with Philip Baskin, May 17, 1985. In our last interview, Mr. Baskin, we dealt with your activities as assistant solicitor and special counsel for the County Law Department and as a member of City Council. Also, you discussed your involvement in local, state, and national Democratic activities. You indicated your strong support for the Scoop Jackson campaign and expressed your feeling that he would have made a good president. What can you tell us about Scoop Jackson, excuse me, and the reasons for your evidently deep admiration?
Well, I think Scoop was basically very stable emotionally and temperamentally, and maybe that's one of the reasons he wasn't very charismatic. A lot of our leading politicians are not as stable, I think, and that's, you know, not too critical. It's just a way of showing the difference. Not too stable emotionally and temperamentally. I mean, you've seen that in some of our presidents and leading political figures.
We certainly saw it with Nixon.
Yes, and with some others. But he was, and he was also very a person of great integrity, really. I mean, he was in public life long, long time. I think about 40 years, and when he died, he didn't have much of an estate. He never used his office really to feather his own nest, and I'd say his character was probably as fine as anybody we've seen in the U.S. Senate, and he was very down-to-earth person, quite modest, and I think, and had a very, very deep knowledge of how government worked. I didn't always agree with everything he was for naturally, nor did he always agree with me. He, on some issues, he was almost a conservative. What I mean by that, he took a viewpoint, for example, on defense that would normally come from the more conservative part of the Senate, on civil rights and other matters. He was very liberal, if you use that term, the way it's loosely thrown about. In no position that I know was he radical in the sense that he took extreme positions. So I thought he was very sound,
balanced
person, and unfortunately he just didn't come across to the public. On the other hand, I think he might have won if it hadn't been for Humphrey, who was a good friend of his, because Pennsylvania was a crucial state in the campaign. Carter ran here, and although Humphrey wasn't an announced candidate, he was a candidate lurking in the closet, and really had a lot of people, including the labor people, who were also friendly to Jackson, thinking that at the convention there would be no clear winner going into the convention, and that therefore then Humphrey could emerge and get the nomination. And I said to them, I thought they were being rather foolish about it, and that it just wasn't going to work that way, that the way the primary system was set up, you had to win in the primary system, and that if they persisted in this tactic, that Carter would probably win Pennsylvania with far less than a majority of the vote, because You'd have people going for Jackson, you'd have people going for Carter, and then you'd have people going for unspecified candidates, delegates, open delegates. And I said once that happened, the campaign would be over. So I think if it hadn't been for that, I think Jackson would have been the nominee. And whether he'd have won, I think he probably would have won, but that's the way politics goes.
Also, in reference to your efforts in the John Kennedy campaign, you stated you were not so much an admirer of John Kennedy as his brother Ted.
Well, let me put it this way. I really didn't know John Kennedy very well. I mean, I knew him and I met him, and met him several times and so forth. But I didn't really know him, and I wasn't sure at the time he came to the presidency that he had the maturity that the position required. And it's hard to make a judgment on John Kennedy because he was president for only 3 years. And I don't think it's fair for anyone to say he was a bad president or he would have been a great president. I don't think
there wasn't time
to make any real judgment. I'll say this, he certainly electrified the country, and he was able to rally people, which I think is a quality that's really necessary in a leader. And going back to Jackson, I think although Jackson inspired confidence, he didn't inspire enthusiasm, and John Kennedy had that capacity. And he might have gone on to be a very good president because he had a capacity for learning.
But so, it's interesting, Carter didn't inspire enthusiasm particularly, yet he managed to be elected.
Well, people were looking for a change, and he came along, and he was different. And when people are dissatisfied, they have a tendency to grasp for anything that promises to be different. That's part of politics, too. But Ted Kennedy, who a lot of people don't think, don't equate Ted Kennedy with his brother, Jack, I've watched develop. I've gotten to know him better. And it seems to me that he's matured a great deal. And he certainly has been a good senator, in the sense that he knows what's going on, he has a good staff, he makes some work, and I think I think clearly, if it weren't for the Chappaquiddick incident, whatever that bearing might have in the future, he'd certainly be the number one choice right now for the Democrats. Now, he may still be, who knows.
That's a hurdle to overcome, though.
Yes, it's less of a hurdle than it was.
As time goes.
Yeah.
Around what issues have you had contact with Ted Kennedy? Was it around Jewish issues or Israel?
Well, some, but not all. some political issues that I thought he expressed opinions that I thought were those that should have been motivating government, you know, and some were Jewish issues as well. He's a great supporter of Israel, but so are a lot of senators. But he is.
What about Robert Kennedy? Did you ever have any contact?
I really had no contact with Robert Kennedy. I had a feeling I didn't like him, but that was so unfounded, really, on anything concrete, that I just dismissed that. And some people who know him say he was the best of the Kennedys. I don't know. I don't have any opinion at all on Bob Kennedy, really, except as you review what he did, even if you started out thinking he was a pretty brash and abrasive young man, you do get a lot more respect, seems to me, for him when you study what he did.
Well, perhaps there was growth with,
yes,
with him and with John.
I think so. And as I said, I'd be the last one in the world to denigrate what either of them did, what they were.
Mr. Baskin, did you have any contacts of interest with other national figures that we could record here?
Well, I had contacts with them, but to say that I was a confidant or close to them would be silly. I wasn't. And there are a number of senators that I got to know over the years, of course, and some congresspeople. I think the closest contact that I really ever had in the White House, I suppose, was Dave Lawrence when Lyndon Johnson was president. Dave Lawrence was helped put Johnson in, of course, and then he was part of the White House entourage in a senior kind of way, in an advisory way. And I was very close to Dave Lawrence, so from that standpoint, I had an insight into what was going on, but I wouldn't say that I was an intimate friend of any president. Or even a close friend.
I believe you were active locally in Walter Mondale's campaign.
Yes, and I've known Walter Mondale for many years, and I like Walter Mondale. I think he deserved better than he got.
What went wrong?
Well, I think I think he had an inevitable loss. I mean, he could have stood on his head and it wouldn't have made any difference. I think Reagan was really riding high in a popularity wave, and when that happens, it doesn't make any difference who's running or what he says. Walter Mondale said a great many things which have proven to be right, but that doesn't make any difference either. And of course, he had almost the same basic fault, quote unquote, as Scoop Jackson did as a political candidate. Was that on a national field, they just didn't have the so-called charisma that you almost need today.
Especially with television.
Yeah, television heightens it. I think you always needed it. FDR certainly had it. Of course, television was really starting then, so he did benefit from that. But it's very difficult to beat a president running for re-election who's affable and personally popular. So, and I think... I never had any illusions about Mondale winning, but you have to put on a good campaign anyway, because there are a lot of other matters. There are legislators to elect, and there are issues to define. And the amazing thing to me in the election was that although Ronald Reagan had a tremendous victory, a historic victory, the Democrats really did very well in the states, for Congress and the Senate and the governors and so forth. So it showed that he had a personal popularity, which at least at that time didn't carry over to the party.
It was a mixed bag. Now to continue with your activities in the Jewish community. At various times, you've been a board member of UJF, Israel Bond Committee. I believe you're presently on the national board, is that correct?
I think so, I'm not sure.
Falk Medical Fund, any observations here, and are you still currently involved?
Well, I've been involved, I suppose my major interest, my major Jewish interest over the years has been Temple Sinai, for one. That's very parochial, of course, and Israel Bonds, and I've been engaged in UJF activities, but I always felt that they had a lot of people who were working for that. Israel Bonds didn't, and so I put more of my time in the bonds. I've helped Histadrut over the years.
What is Histadrut?
Well, Histadrut is it's a strange creation, you know. It's the labor organization in Israel, which represents almost the entire working force. But it's more than a labor union, because it's also an employer in Israel. It establishes health plans and so forth. So it's been the vital force in Israel for many years. I've taken the position that that all these organizations do a lot of good, or at least some good, and that probably ought to help them. Where some people believe in focusing on one. So as a result, I've helped with the JNF, which I think has done a great deal for Israel, and Histadrut, which isn't too popular here. It isn't popular because, first of all, it's labor-oriented, so that wouldn't appeal as much to our more affluent Jewish leaders, even though they are probably more liberal than affluent non-Jewish leaders. And the UJF, of course, gets the most support. It's the charitable thing, and maybe it is more important than any of them because it covers so many things. They all serve a useful function. The only problem that I see is that I think there's a lot of duplication today.
I was going to say, is there overlapping?
Yeah, you take, for example, I helped somewhat with the Anti-Defamation League, not a great deal, but I help every year. And the AJC, although I'm not really an active member, I've been on the board, they've honored me as a Man of the Year once. But it seems to me they overlap a great deal in some of their activities. And I think what we're seeing happen is so many organizations seeking funds and support that there may be a weakening down the line, unless maybe the UJF takes hold and tries to bring some order out of what's been happening.
Coordinate in a sense.
Well, and that's difficult too, because they want their own first. So,
they want their own identity.
Yeah, it's. But I think that's what's happening, and it's probably causing some problems. But I don't know how much you can do about it.
You were on many missions to Israel, I believe. When was your earliest mission?
I think I started. I think it was after the 67 war. I think that's what it was.
How many times have you been there?
Oh, about a dozen, at least a dozen times.
And your most recent?
I think my recent was a private trip, which my wife and I took with two other couples. Mm-hmm. And that was about, I guess a year and a half ago.
I guess you observed a lot of development over the years.
Yes, a lot, a great deal. Been some tremendous progress made. And really, when you look at history and you look at how countries have started and developed, this certainly has to be a story worth telling and thinking about. It's unfortunate that there's certain negative aspects of it that really worrisome, but
you're referring to the Palestinian situation.
Well, that and the general war kind of footing that they're always on. But I can't recall any country in history that had quite the moral kind of foundation that this country started with, you know, welcoming anybody who would come and making a home for anybody that needed it, whether they were good for the state or not, or a drag on the state. I don't know of any, unless it was the U.S., you know, during the early years of its development, when it welcomed immigrants, but even that doesn't approach, it seems to me.
Do you feel some of this moral effect was lost with the Beirut invasion? That is the way the world observed.
Well,
Israel.
Yes and no. Wars have a way of bringing everybody down. Wars have a way of they may bring out the best, perhaps, in individuals, but I think they bring out the worst in nations as a whole. So, in that respect, the wars haven't done Israel any good either. But, on the other hand, here they are, their backs to the wall economically, and yet they went out of their way to bring black Jews from Ethiopia in.
Yes.
And here we are in the U.S., the most... the wealthiest nation by far in the world, and with the most resources, and we keep trying to keep people out. So I think that it still maintained that kind of moral foundation, but there's no question that the wars have weakened them, not just economically, but wars have a way of tearing down the fibers of people, I think.
In the many trips to Israel, was there any specific thing that you were interested in and any that you directed your attention to?
No.
Or
I,
was it just global?
Just general. I never could figure out their economy. I always thought that someday they're going to have to pay for the way they did things with indexing and inflation, but...
Of course, that's what's going on now.
Well, I kid my Republican friends and I tell them that they don't realize it, but the state of Israel are really the first modern supply-siders, I think. I mean, they had absolutely the same sort of rationale for their economic policy that supply-siders have over here today, and I think the same thing's going to happen to us. Maybe not as grave, because we have so many more resources, but I think we'll probably see some of the same things happening here economically.
You must have had contacts with many prominent Israelis in all these countries.
Yes, I think
almost all. Can
you
tell us about some of them?
Yeah, well, they're like prominent people everywhere. And the closer you get to them, the more you realize they're just frail human beings. Although some really have great qualities of leadership. Yeah, sure. There's no question that Ben Gurion and Golda Meir were very impressive people.
Well, they were the giants, weren't they?
Yeah, they really were. Of course, there were some giants before them that I didn't really. No. And there were, I'd met them all, Rabin, who, and Diane, you know, and almost anyone that you can mention of any band. And they were remarkable people. But it's very interesting when you get up close to great leaders, and you find they're really... really made about the same material as most people.
What do you think about the present political situation
there? Where?
In Israel, yes.
Well, you know, it's just temporary. It can't last. Mm-hmm. And I think everybody realized that it was the only expedient thing to do temporarily. How long that lasts is problematical, I think. They have a real political problem in Israel with all these different parties, you know. It makes it makes forming and running a government very difficult. And of course, that's complicated by the religious problem that they have. So when you take their political makeup, all these parties, and you take the religious problem that they have, and you take the war problems and the defense problems and the immigration problem, you wonder how they even exist, which again is a testament to something, staying power and determination and so forth.
Let's hope it stays.
Well, but they need a lot of help.
Yes, they do.
They need a lot of help. And they deserve it, the help they're getting from the U.S. I don't think anybody has to apologize for. I think the U.S. gets more for its dollar in helping Israel than it does for any dollar that it puts out anyplace else or for its defense. So I never feel apologetic about it.
Also, you've had an active role with the Soviet jury.
Yes.
I believe you visited Russia in 1977.
Yeah, I think my wife and I and the Sircones, Judge Sircone and his wife, went over on a so-called mission. We were supposed to visit with the Refuseniks.
Did you go under anyone's auspices or just...
Well, yes and no. We were supposedly just touring, but, you know, I don't think we kidded the Russians one bit. They never bothered us, but they always followed us. And they knew what we were doing, but they never... It was one of those funny kind of periods where when we landed, we went through customs as though there was nothing to it. We got out of it as though there was nothing to it. We went wherever we wanted to go, and yet we knew we could see them watching. And we met with a lot of the famous Refuseniks, including Sharansky. In fact, I always thought we were a jinx that we met with him in a group at a home just about a week, I think, before they picked him up. So we always thought maybe we had something to do with it. But and we met with quite a few of them, and they had a lot of spirit, really. Tremendous. When we went to meet with Sharansky and the group that he had, I forget some of the names of some of the people there, but they were teaching each other Hebrew and English. Now, you weren't supposed to speak Hebrew, you know, but they were teaching each other Hebrew and English. And they had regular classes. And we visited the synagogues, some of them very old, and some of them towns like Tashkent, which is in Mongolia, and in Georgia, Tbilisi, and very sad to see them. We went to one, I forget now where it was, but it was just taken care of by an old man and his wife, you know. Probably, I don't know if he had been a rabbi at one time, or it was just the old shamus that was left, you know. Very, very sad to see that. On the other hand, we saw them, we were over there about just before Passover, and we saw them making matzah. And that was encouraging. It's.
How did you make contact with these Refuseniks?
Well, we had the names, but they had no telephones, you know, and we had addresses, but it's very difficult getting around Russia, and we didn't know a word of Russian, but it's amazing how we found almost everybody we were supposed to see in every city that we were supposed to see them in. I told Sircone, it looked like we were like Abbott and Costello loose in Russia. If the Russians were following us, they must have thought if we were the CIA, boy, they didn't have anything to worry about, I'll tell you that. But we did manage. It's amazing. We managed to see everybody we were supposed to see. We managed to see some Russian officials about them in I think in Tashkent we met with what was the Bar Association people there, including, and there was one who was Jewish who was very happy to see us start talking Yiddish, but he said, you know, I'm a communist. He says, don't. we did do a lot in Ceylon. And don't ask me how. You know, a funny thing about Russia, if you can speak Yiddish, you can get along. It's amazing.
You mean with the Jewish population?
Yes. It's all you have to know.
Well, that's probably true in most countries.
But I'll tell you, trying to get to some of these places, no
phone. How long were you there?
I think we were there about 2 weeks.
I see. It sounds like you covered a lot of ground.
We did. We traveled by, and the Russians were very nice to us. We got the first seats on the plane. They gave us a guide in every city, and almost wherever we wanted to go, we went. And that must have been one of their good periods.